Okay, so let's begin with our motivation. So today I participated in a panel discussion on dukkha with three other Buddhist teachers, and it was organized by the Buddhist magazine Buddha Dharma. So they're going to edit it and I guess make it into an article. But the topic was dukkha, unsatisfactory conditions. And so we talked about the different kinds of unsatisfactory circumstances we experience in cyclic existence and how important it was to identify these and to recognize these in our experience, and then to develop the aspiration to be free of them. So the Buddhist teachings is really anchored on this. You know, the four truths that form the basic outline of the Buddhist teachings: true dukkha, true origin, true cessation, true path. Now they center around our unsatisfactory experiences, so we can see them clearly, see their causes clearly. Because if we misidentify the causes of our unhappiness, then we're likely to get quite confused about what the path to be free of them is. So from a Buddhist perspective, the causes of our unhappiness are internal, our own afflicted states of mind, the karma that we ourselves created. And when we're aware of that, then we come to see that we have the power to overcome these. And if we do so, then we'll attain a state of peace or nirvana. Whereas if the source of our unhappiness is external to us, then there's not really much we can do to overcome it, because we cannot control other people. We try, but we're not so successful. And so to come back to that awareness and be responsible for the state of our mind, be responsible for our actions, and in that way be able to create the causes for happiness and abandon the causes of suffering, so that we eventually we can attain full awakening, where we have the wisdom, compassion, power to really serve other living beings effectively. So let's make that our long-term aim, and sharing the teachings together this evening is one drop in the bucket going in that direction. So this thing about being responsible for our own experiences is really quite important, yeah? Because our usual approach is to blame the circumstances around us for our unhappiness. Yeah. I don't think you need to write this down. I think you have heard it many times. Yeah? Yeah. When we're unhappy, when we're angry, for example, something happened, we're unhappy, we're angry. Why? Why are we unhappy and angry? They did this. They did that. He did this. She did that. These people did this. Point, 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 point. Isn't it? Always somebody else. They need to change. And I'm going to yell and scream at them until they change. Or I'm going to go sulk in my room and not speak to them until they change. But until they change, I'm going to hold on to my anger and I'm unhappy and I am justified. Yeah? And so this is our standard pattern, isn't it? Yeah, we've been doing this since beginningless time. Where has it gotten us? Yeah, where has it gotten us? Nowhere. Nowhere. We're still sitting here saying other people are wrong and they're the source of my misery. Yeah. Even the people who are being kind to us, sometimes people are trying to help us. We blast them even harder. I don't want, you're trying to help me? No, you're bossing me around. You're punishing me. You're doing this, you're doing that. Yeah? Where does that get us? We just dig ourselves into a big ditch. And then we jump in, we decorate the ditch with the photographs of everybody we hate. We meditate on them daily and how much they've harmed us. This one harmed me in first grade. This one harmed me in second grade. This one harmed me on and on and on and on. Isn't it? They're all surrounding us. And the world doesn't understand us. And all these people do these things that drive me crazy. Why don't they change? Because I'm sweet, innocent, cooperative, compassionate me. Who just wants to be happy, and these people don't understand me. And they do all these mean things to me, and they don't even give me a chance to explain my side of the story. They just shut me down. Oh, it's always like that. Yeah? So inside our heart, there is the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury. And they all work for the self-grasping mind and the self-centered mind. So here's this other person. Maybe they were upset and they did something that we didn't like. Maybe they were trying to help us and they said something we didn't like. And the prosecutor goes after them. The judge, the jury's convicts them, the judge sentences them, and the conclusion is we are right and they are wrong. There we go. Yes. That's the truth. I'm now satisfied. I have justice. They're wrong. I'm right. That make you happy? Does that get rid of your suffering? Even the whole world says we're right and they're wrong. Does that get rid of our unhappiness inside? Okay. So the real cause of our unhappiness is we have, in this example, we have the seed of anger in our own mind. As long as we have the seed of anger in our own mind, we will find somebody to hate. And we will see many people as uncooperative and hateful towards us, as long as we have that seed of anger inside. Yeah? And that seed of anger comes because of ignorance. We apprehend things as existing in a way they don't. Yeah? Can any laws in the country get rid of your ignorance and the seed of your anger inside? Yeah? Can any National Guards people will come and rescue you from your anger and your ignorance? Can the lottery remove it? Winning the lottery remove it? Can the entire world and all sentient beings bow down on their knees and apologize to you for every wrong they have ever committed against you? Will that satisfy you and free you from your pain? Yeah? Imagine that. You're sitting there on a big golden throne, and all the sentient beings around you who have mistreated you, who've discriminated against you, who have called you names, who have accused you of doing things you never did. Yeah, they're all there on their hands saying, "Forgive me." Does that get rid of your pain? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. The only thing that gets rid of our pain is getting rid of the ignorance, getting rid of the seed of anger. That's the only thing that's going to do it. Yeah? So that's what we have to work on. And it's for that reason that we're studying logic and reasoning and debate. Okay, because studying logic and reasoning and debate will show us how to think clearly and show us how to refute the perspective of ignorance, the wrong view of ignorance. So that's why we're studying this. Okay. Before I get into that this evening, somebody had written a question. I think last time I must have said something about Vipassana. Did I say something? I can't remember it clearly. I probably did in the context of we use reasoning and debate to do insight meditation. Yeah, meditating on emptiness, refuting the way ignorance perceives objects. And so that type of meditation is called Vipassana. Yeah. And I don't remember it so well, but from the note I got from somebody, it looks like I said it. I was probably saying that nowadays, in the West, people often think there's three types of Buddhism: Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan. Or Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana. Okay? And that's an incorrect way to talk about the kinds of Buddhism. Yeah? Because one point is Vipassana is a meditation technique. It's not a Buddhist tradition. And so all the Buddhist traditions have Vipassana meditation in them. Okay? And the word Vipassana nowadays, it's used in a lot of very different circumstances, and the people who say that we practice Vipassana, because there's many different groups, many different Vipassana teachers and so on, and some say that they're Buddhist, some I'm not sure if they say if they're Buddhist, I'm not sure, okay? There are some who say that they follow the Theravada tradition, and then some Vipassana teachers are hesitant to say they follow the Theravada tradition. Okay, there's many different kinds, so it's up to I wasn't speaking of one particular Vipassana tradition last week. Vipassana, yeah, it's taught in the context of the Four Truths. So when there were some people who went to Southeast Asia, they learned Vipassana meditation, and they came back to the West and taught it. They then this is the time, this is historical. But actually, you know, this is a topic for somebody's PhD thesis, to trace the development of the different Buddhist traditions in the West. You know, because when they came back, they very deliberately just taught it as a meditation technique and did not teach it so much in a Buddhist context, in the sense of, you know, the three baskets and teaching Vinaya and Sutra and Abhidharma. They basically taught one form of Theravada Vipassana. There's many forms of Theravada Vipassana, and taught it in that way. Okay, and so, but I think, like now, there's many forms, and the way those initial people taught it may be quite different now, because I think I remember hearing that some of them at one point went to some Tibetan teachers for teachings, and so, you know, there they're going to get the whole perspective of the four truths and everything. So maybe they brought some more of that back into their tradition. But I wasn't talking about one particular group, and I wasn't criticizing anything anybody did. Okay? Just to get that clear. Okay, so now we're on chapter 4, the comparison of phenomena. Okay, so the most important framework for Buddhist debate is the comparison of phenomena. Thus, it is the first skill to acquire. One of the main characteristics of our knowledge is understanding the boundaries of pervasion. So there's a technical term. Okay, the boundaries of pervasion between phenomena. Okay, so he's going to explain it here. So, for instance, we find it interesting that all spiders are arachnids, but there are arachnids that are not spiders, such as ticks. We're very familiar with both, aren't we? Okay, the boundaries of pervasion, or the extension of a phenomena, is its range. What it includes and what it excludes. Okay? So, yeah, by understanding clearly a phenomena's boundary of pervasion, we are able to ascertain the scope of that phenomena. Okay? So, let me read the paragraph and then I'll explain some things. As practiced in this system, when comparing two things, such as arachnids and spiders, the question is not whether or not one thing is the other. Rather, the question is whether or not there are things that are both, and whether or not there is anything that is one but not the other. Okay? It may be helpful to think of this as class inclusion. Yeah. So that helps us understand it. If you may remember in math class studying Venn diagrams, do you remember that, where you drew circles and you had different things, and there's two circles here and there's ones where one big circle and one little circle, and then another one where the two circles have an overlapping area and two circles, what, you know? So that's this kind of thing. So each circle represents a class of phenomena, and you're comparing two different classes of phenomena. Okay, so you're not comparing their characteristics or things like that. You're comparing what things belong to this class, one things belong to this. Is there something that belongs to both? You know, something that is neither. Okay, so you're trying to understand how these different groups of things relate to each other. Okay, so, yeah, I'll explain pervasion as we go on. The focus is on the members of the class that together characterize the class. By comparing two phenomena and establishing their relative boundaries of pervasion, the limits of each phenomena in relation to the other, we come to understand the points of similarity and dissimilarity between them. So if you're going to talk about arachnids and you're going to talk about spiders, yeah, then you want to know what's the relationship between them. Okay, so arachnids is a bigger category, isn't it? Spiders is a smaller category, because within the big category of arachnids, you have spiders, you have ticks. What else do you have? Mites. What else? Scorpions? Oh, yeah. Okay, so you have a lot of other critters that are arachnids, but are not spiders. Okay? So if you were going to draw a diagram, you would have the big circle of arachnids, and within that, a small circle of spiders. Okay, so then the way the privation goes is, if it's a spider, it is an arachnid. Yeah? So arachnids pervade being spiders. Yeah, all spiders are arachnids. Are all arachnids spiders? No. For example, ticks. Okay. Are all spiders arachnids? Yes. Okay. So is there both something that's an arachnid and a spider? Yes. So I'm saying the same thing in different ways because there's different ways to say it. Okay. Is there something that's neither an arachnid nor a spider? For example, cat? Fly, yeah, okay, a tree. Is there something that is an arachnid that is not a spider? We did that one already, yeah. And there's something that's a spider. Is there something that's a spider that's not an arachnid? No, because all arachnids are spiders. All the spiders are arachnids, okay? So that's telling you something about these classes, isn't it? You know, it's telling you that there's something about spiders, you know, that arachnids have certain characteristics and spiders fulfill at least some of those characteristics. Okay. The philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein is often remembered for saying, "For a large class of cases, though not for all, the meaning of a word is its use in the language." Okay? The meaning of a word is its use in the language. Yeah. The comparison of phenomena as practiced here explores the way that terms are used. However, do not think that this process of comparison is directed solely at discovering the limits of how a word is used. Okay? Rather, since Buddhists believe that we are liberated through understanding the nature of things, for them the process of reasoning and debate is intended to serve as a tool for understanding how phenomena being referred to actually exist in the world, not just how the words are used. Okay, so even though we're using words, yeah, we're talking about the phenomena and trying to examine how those different phenomena exist. We're not just doing a linguistic lesson. Okay. Still, because the word symbols are of such critical importance, the Buddhists present extensive thought on language as well. The style of comparison assumes three things to work, okay? There can only be two things being compared, yeah? So at one time, you only compare two things. You don't compare three things, okay? So you keep your Venn diagram simple, yeah? Not too many circles at one time. Two, both of those things must exist. So the classes that we're talking about must exist. They cannot be non-existent classes. The members of those groups may be non-existent, but the groups themselves must be existent. And then three, those two things must be different, because we can't compare two things that are the same. Okay. Now, different means that they're different either in meaning or in name. So there can be two things that are synonymous, but because they have different names, they're considered different. Why? Because you're looking, how you look at them is different. The meaning you're taking from it is different. Okay? So, for example, conditioned phenomena and impermanent. Okay? They're synonyms. They refer to the same things. Yeah, everything that's impermanent is conditioned. Everything that's conditioned is impermanent. There's nothing that is neither of them. But when you say impermanent, does that give you a different meaning than when you say conditioned? What's the difference in meaning?
Changing moment by moment as compared to due to causes and conditions.
Right. Okay, so when we say impermanent, we mean something that's changing moment to moment. When we say conditioned phenomena, we're talking about something that comes into being doing causes and conditions, because of causes and conditions. So those are two different meanings, don't they? Aren't they? I mean, they bring to mind different understandings. Somebody can understand impermanent things very well. They can understand conditioned things very well. But they can do that without understanding that these two things are mutually inclusive. Yeah? And so here's where reasoning comes in, you know, because if it's easier to understand, let's say, the meaning of arising due to causes and conditions, then you can use that as a reason to show why those same things are impermanent. Okay, so for example, so it's kind of easier, isn't it, to understand that things come into being due to causes and conditions than to understand that they're changing in each nanosecond. Yeah? Easier to understand? Yeah, we're just talking gross. You know, they come in because we see things, there's causes. You plant the seed, you get the sprout. We understand that. Yeah, we don't understand necessarily that the seed and the sprout are changing in every smallest moment, never remaining the same. Okay. So we may say to somebody who understands conditioned things, but they don't understand impermanent things, yeah, that the seed is impermanent because it's conditioned. Then the person goes, okay, I know the seed is conditioned, yeah, because I've seen the seed be created. There was the pine cone and that grew from the tree and the seed fell off of that. So because it was created by causes and conditions, then it must be changing in every single moment. Wow. You know, and then all of a sudden they have some new knowledge. And they start to think, well, why? If it's created by causes and conditions, why must it change in every nanosecond? Why can't it remain the same? Because causes themselves are changing, aren't they? Yeah, the cause has to change for the result to come into existence. Yeah, and when we plant the seed, it isn't that it's a seed permanent without changing at all. And then in 1 second it becomes a sprout. Yeah. We know enough gardening to know that that seed, you know, slowly opens. There's a sprout that kind of slowly pokes out. You know, that it's something that takes time, that's changing over time. Yeah? So that when somebody says to you, the seed is impermanent because it's produced by causes and conditions, then you go, yeah, that's right. I never thought of it before, that the seed actually changes in each nanosecond. You know, I always thought, well, I never thought about it before. You know? Okay, and then somebody gives you that argument, oh, yeah, I better think about that. Okay? So in these two cases, permanent and conditioned, you know, they're mutually inclusive. So if you were going to draw circles, you would have two circles, one right on top of each other, with the same perimeter. One circle would not be larger than the other. Okay? Whereas with arachnids and spiders, spider circle is smaller, arachnid circle is bigger. Okay? So what about if I say spatula and kitchen utensils? What would it be? How would you draw that? Yeah. Okay, so the big circle is kitchen utensils. In it is a spatula. Okay. What if I said, let me think of something. Nothing's coming to mind right now. Okay, so much for that. I should have written down some examples before, so I have them come to mind. I'll think of something. Okay, so let's go into these three conditions a little bit more. So only two things may be compared at a time. So for instance, how do fruits and citrus fruits compare? Okay, how do fruits and citrus fruits compare? Big category is fruit, citrus fruit. Okay. So the way I learned it is we talk about four points of pervasion. He calls it three possibilities, four possibilities. Okay. But when we're comparing fruit and citrus fruit, okay, we have to look at four ways they could possibly relate. So is there something that is both fruit and citrus fruit? Example, orange. Okay. Is there something that is a citrus fruit that is not a fruit? No. Is there something that is a fruit that is not a citrus fruit? An apple. Is there something that is neither a fruit nor a citrus fruit? Yeah, our cats. Okay. Okay. So there is those four, you were comparing in 4 points, and we found examples for three of them. One of them we couldn't find an example for. Which one was that? Something that's a citrus fruit but not a fruit. We couldn't find an example for that one. Okay, so that's why he says there's three possibilities. But I always like going through all four, you know. That's how I learned it. Okay, so only two things may be compared at a time. Fruit, how do fruits and citrus fruits compare? Even though only two things may be compared at a time, like anyone else, a Buddhist thinker might bear multiple things in mind at the same time, but But the procedure in debate is to assess the comparison of things two by two. So you may have a whole bunch of things in your mind wondering how they compare, but you have to go through them two by two. You can't do them all at once. Okay? So we might understand how P and Q compare, then how Q and R compare, then how P and R compare. By this technique, in the end, the understanding is complete. But you don't compare Q, P, and R all at one time. Okay. It is okay to have a disjunctive grouping on one or both sides. That is, a group of either this or that. Okay? So, how do fruits and either citrus fruits or berries compare? So what you're comparing are fruits and either citrus fruits or berries. Okay. What's an example of either citrus fruits or berries? A lemon. What's another example? A strawberry. Okay. So those are examples of one of the things, either citrus fruits or berries. Then there's fruit. Okay. So what's the comparison between fruit and either citrus fruits or berries? Okay, so how are you going to draw the circles? The big circle is fruit. The small circle is either citrus fruit or berry. Okay? So the small circle is either citrus fruits or berries. So in that small circle, you're going to have lemons and orange and raspberries and blueberries, because all of those are either a citrus fruit or a berry. Okay? So is there something that is both a citrus fruit or a berry and a fruit? For example, orange. What's another example? Strawberry. Okay. Is there something that is either a citrus fruit or a berry, but is not a fruit? No. Is there something that is a fruit, but not either a citrus fruit or a berry? Banana. Is there something that is neither a citrus fruit or berry or a fruit? A table. Oh, yeah. Oh, potato. You said table, too. Yeah, don't you pronounce table potato? Okay. So, okay. Since oranges are always citrus fruits, this last one is no different from asking how fruits and oranges compare. So that there is little point, you know, in it. However, bear in mind that it is preferred to compare just two things, not groups. Okay? Or actually, you're comparing groups of two groups. Okay? This is usually challenging enough. So that's the first thing, that you only compare two things at a time, even though one of them may be a disjunctive thing, this or that. Yeah, so the disjunctive group, yeah, a group of either this or that, such as how do fruit and either citrus fruits or berries compare, is also okay to have a conjunctive grouping on one or both sides, a group of both this and that, such as how do fruits and things that are both citrus fruits and oranges compare. Okay. You can't say, how are things that are both citrus fruits and berries compare? Because there's nothing, that's a non-existent. But the conjunctive group, something that's both a citrus fruit and an orange. Okay. Yeah, so I skipped that. Yeah, so then since oranges are always citrus fruits. This last one is no different from saying, how do fruits and oranges compare? So there's little point in it, okay? Then the second point, the two things being compared have to be existent. It would be possible to compare apples and oranges by this process, but how does the horn of a rabbit compare to apples? Yeah? Let's do apples to oranges, because we always talk about comparing apples and oranges, but here the meaning of comparing apples and oranges is different, okay? So, how would you draw the circles for apples and oranges? Two separate circles, okay? Is there something that's both apples and oranges? No. Is there something that's an apple but not an orange? What? A Macintosh apple. Is there something that's both, that's an orange but not an apple? A navel orange, okay. Is there something that's neither an apple nor an orange? A pear, okay. Okay. But, so we just saw you can compare apples and oranges. But if I say it to you, how does an apple compare to a horn of a rabbit? The horn of rabbits don't exist. How can you compare them to anything? They're totally non-existent. Okay, so you can't compare, yeah, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, rabbit's horns, okay, the non-existence of climate change. You can't compare non-existent things to anything. Okay? Yeah.
Can you compare the I that we think exists but that doesn't exist with anything?
No, you can only compare the conventional I that exists. You can't compare an inherently existent I because it's non-existent. Even though we believe in it. Okay? You can't compare the man in the moon to anybody, even though we may believe in the man in the moon. Okay? So our believing something exists does not make that thing exist. It has to be perceivable by a reliable cognizer to exist. Us believing it exists doesn't work. Like the emperor's new clothes. Yeah? All these people, except this little kid, believe that the emperor had new clothes on. That didn't make the emperor have new clothes. Okay. Okay. Okay, so how does the horn of a rabbit compare to apples? That does not work in this system. The horn of a rabbit does not have any qualities because it does not exist. Okay? Thus, there is nothing in the group. Empty sets, so this is like set theory, empty sets, sometimes called null sets, are out of this game because there are no members having any qualities that may or may not overlap with another group having members. Okay, so that's why you can't compare them. Still, oh, now here we get into lovely things. I love non-cows. Oh, yeah, okay, so we talk about all these things. Something such as a non-cow, which applies as well to the horn of a rabbit as it does to a horse, in that the horn of a rabbit is a non-cow. And also, a horse is a non-cow. So a non-cow may be compared to other existence. So every non-existent is a non-cow. But there are existent members of the class of non-cows, too, such as horses. So non-cow is not an empty set. Okay, so what is a non-cow? Cow is a positive phenomena or an affirmed phenomena in the sense that a cow is something that's there. A non-cow, yeah, is everything that isn't a cow. So it's just negating cow. But there's lots of things that aren't cows. For example, us. Although sometimes some people may call us a cow when we eat too much. Okay? But, you know, there's cows and non-cows, yeah, are contradictory. There can't be anything that's both. They're mutually exclusive. Yeah? So a non-cow has existent members, the thermos, the gong, the paper. It also, a weapon of mass destruction in Iraq is also a non-cow because it's not a cow. Yeah? An inherently existent I, which does not exist, is also not a cow. Okay, then three, the third criteria, is that the two things being compared must be different. It would be senseless to ask how do colors and colors compare? Colors and colors are the same thing. You can't compare them. Okay? So you can only compare two things that are different. You can compare blue and colors. Okay? But you can't compare colors to colors because they're the same thing. Okay? Okay? They don't compare in any way because they are only alike, not different at all. Everything that exists is self-identical. In other words, it is identical to itself. Yeah? Everything is itself. So there is no comparison between colors and colors. Colors are identical with colors. In this process of comparison, the two things being compared may be different in no other way than just being different names for the same thing. For example, impermanent and conditioned. Or they may be entirely separate phenomena, like household furniture and table. Okay? We often say you have to compare apples to apples. We usually understand this to mean that the things being compared have to be comparable, that is, similar in some ways, such that they can be compared. In addition, one implication of that saying is that you do not look at just one type of thing only and speak of it. You have to have at least two types of things to compare. Okay. So when we say in regular English, you have to compare apples to apples, you know, or you can't compare oranges and apples. In Buddhist thing, you can compare oranges and apples. So the meaning of that expression is different. But in the sense that our ordinary expression of you have to compare apples to apples means that you have to have at least, you know, two types of things to compare. Yeah. Okay. We can't say, I compare this carpet to this carpet, because they're the same thing. We can say, I compare today's carpet to yesterday's carpet. Okay. Oh, let's try that one. That one's interesting. How would you compare today's carpet to yesterday's carpet? Is there something that's both? No. Is there something that's yesterday's carpet but not today's carpet? What? Yesterday's carpet. For example, you have to cite a member of the group. This carpet yesterday. Yeah. Is there something that's today's carpet but not yesterday's carpet? Yes. For example, this carpet today. Okay. Is there something that is neither yesterday's carpet nor today's carpet? What? The desk, but it's more clever to say tomorrow's carpet. Yeah. Yeah, tomorrow's carpet is neither today's carpet nor yesterday's carpet. Yeah, it exists. Yeah, future objects exist. Yeah, in that the causes for them, you know, are, but you, yeah, future objects. Because you can also say, you can also answer horn of a rabbit. Is there something that's neither today's carpet nor tomorrow or yesterday's carpet, a horn of a rabbit? Okay. But it's more clever to cite something that's kind of similar to those two things, but different. Because that hones in, you know, exactly what you're looking at. Okay. You have to have at least two types of things to compare. The sense of the saying is that the same standards of analysis have to be applied to both sides. Anyway, any two types of things that exist are comparable as apples to apples because they are both existence. The way he's explaining may get us confused. The basic point is, apple, you have to have two things that are existent, and they have to be different things. Okay, that's the main thing. Okay, they share, okay. Actually, in this system of reasoning, being different implies being existent. Okay, this is because non-existents do not have any qualities at all. So, for instance, we may not say that the horn of a rabbit is different from a diamond. You can't compare a horn of a rabbit and a diamond. Okay, both things have to be existent. They have to be different. Yeah. By the same token, we cannot say it is the same as a diamond either. Yeah. So in some ways, saying it's different is the same as saying it's existent. Okay? Because to have two things that are existent, they have to be different to compare them. Okay? Since being different implies being existent. Yeah. Because something that is non-existent cannot be the same as something or different from something. Okay? You getting that? Yeah. Okay. Since being different implies being existent, it would be suitable to drop existence as the second requirement in this list and just say that there are only two requirements for the comparison to work. Only two phenomena may be compared at a time, and those two phenomena must be different. Because he wrote a book before called Debate in Tibetan Buddhism, so he's talking a little bit about some terminology switches that he did. There are a couple differences from the phrasing used in this book and what is in Debate in Tibetan Buddhism. In the earlier book, Debate in Tibetan Buddhism, the introductory question of comparison is phrased, what is the difference between the two existent and hidden phenomena? Okay, first, rather than what is the difference between these two, the question has become how do these two things compare? Okay, so he's just changing the language. The old way is very close to the Tibetan. However, the new way is more in line with how we would say it in English. Typically, when you ask people about the difference between this or that, they will seek to give a descriptive response. This might go along the lines of, well, this is more such and such, and that is more so and so. For instance, if you ask somebody, what is the difference between a parolee and a person on probation, that person will describe the qualities of a parolee and the qualities of a person on probation. This is not what the Tibetan question is meant to get at. Okay. Rather, the question in debate is intended to address whether or not there could be something, someone who is both a parolee and on probation, whether or not all parolees are on probation, and whether a person on probation would have to be a parolee. Okay? So it's just saying that when we say in English, what's the difference between these two things? We usually think in descriptive terms of the two categories. Whereas when we say, how would you compare this to this, we're talking about how do you compare the members of this group to the members of that group. And that's what we're talking about in debate. So that's why he changed the terminology. Okay. A second big change in this question from debate in Tibetan Buddhism is the change from always referring to the entire group, the class, in the singular, to generally referring to the entire group in the plural. Okay? Because in Tibetan, they don't necessarily indicate plural. Sometimes they do. They put the word sok at the end to indicate plural, but sometimes they don't. They also don't have the pronouns a and the. Yeah, whereas in English, a and the have very different meanings. And it's hard for us to think without, you know, because saying this is a thermos and this is the thermos have two different meanings. In Tibetan, you just say this is thermos. There's no a and there's no the. Yeah, different way of thinking. So in Tibetan, when they write it out, they would say, what's the difference between thermos and window? Okay. What sounds better in English? This is the difference, you know, or how do thermos and window compare? Or how do thermoses and windows compare? Which one sounds better in English? Plural. Yeah, because we're comparing groups. How do thermoses and windows compare? We wouldn't say, how do thermos and window compare? Okay.
The problem when you read that first book is, before he fixed this language, was it took a really long time to figure out what they were talking about, because you couldn't figure out. It seemed like, are they talking about the class itself, or are they talking about the members?
Member.
It was not clear at all, and sometimes they played on that to mix you up also. But in general, it was very confusing for long time.
And right.
So, he's really
so that's
that
why he changed the terminology. Mm-hmm. And that's also why some debates in Tibetan don't make any sense in English, because they'll make a debate in Tibetan based on how the language is used, but it doesn't translate and make sense in English. Yeah? Okay. For example, in debate in Tibetan Buddhism, a question may be phrased as, what is the difference between the two, existent and hidden phenomenon? But now, after considerable experience going over this stuff in the classroom with English speakers, I find the use of the plurals for comparisons is just irresistible. Because you wouldn't say, how do existence and phenomenon compare, plural? Or singular, you would say, how do existence and phenomena, meaning the class, compare? That seems to be how we refer to the entire group, by using the plural. So now the question is most often stated using plurals. For example, how do existence and hidden phenomena compare? This works better. The plurals tip us off that we are talking about entire groups. Okay, you want to do this one of existence and hidden phenomena? Okay, so to do them, to compare two things, you have to know the definition of what two things are. So existence, existence, we know what that means, things that exist, things perceived by a reliable cognizance. What does hidden phenomena mean? Or I usually translated it as obscure phenomena. What's the meaning of obscure phenomena?
We usually talk about slightly hidden phenomena and extremely hidden phenomena.
Yeah, and they can grow in the general group. So, and what's the other group in there too?
Manifest
or evident phenomena. So you can have two, evident phenomena, hidden phenomena. What's the difference between them? When you see with direct perception, what's hidden phenomena? The first time you understand it, you have to use inference to understand it. Okay, so something that's a hidden phenomena to some people doesn't have to be a hidden phenomena to everybody. Okay, so what is the thermos? Is it, let's go back to using obscure. Is it evident or obscure? Evident. Okay. What is gross impermanence, like the sun setting? Evident. What is subtle impermanence? It's obscure. To know subtle impermanence, things changing moment by moment, you have to use reasoning to understand it at the beginning. Your eyes cannot see things changing that quickly. Okay, what about emptiness and the emptiness of inherent existence? Is it evident or obscure? It's obscure. Why? Because you have to first understand it using inference. You can't just say, emptiness of inherent existence, and boing, you got it. Okay, so how would you compare existence and obscure phenomena? Is there something that is both existent and an obscure phenomena? Yeah. There's something that's both existent and an obscure phenomena. Yes, for example, subtle impermanence. Okay, it's both existent and an obscure phenomena. Is there something that is an existent but not an obscure phenomena? Yes, for example, gross impermanence. Yeah, or a turtle. Yeah. Is there something that is an obscure phenomena that is not existent? No, there's nothing that's an obscure phenomena that is also existent. Of course, no, emptiness isn't existent. Otherwise, what are we meditating on? It just means it exists. Emptiness exists. Okay. Is there something that is neither existent nor an obscure phenomena? Yes. For example, turtle's mustache. Yeah. On that one, you can only posit a non-existent. That is neither an existent nor an obscure phenomena. Okay? However, changing to plurals is not universally better. For existence, if the question is how do blue and the colors of cloth compare, it is better to use blue rather than blues. Okay, because blue in the singular seems to refer to the general class. Okay, there are several occasions where it remains better to use the singular. Because anyway, blues has a totally different meaning than blue, doesn't it? Okay. So what are the ways that any two different existent phenomena may compare? Okay. It is easier to visualize the possible comparisons. He calls it Euler diagrams. I remember it being called Venn diagrams. Yeah. Anyway, these diagrams. As represented in the diagrams that follow, there are four ways the two circles may compare. So look at the way the circles relate. So he's referring later on in your book. In the top one, which is called Three Possibilities, one circle is entirely inside the other. Okay? See, I don't call that Three Possibilities because there's, in some situations, you can only come up with two things. So I always say, how do this and this compare? Let's go through the four points. And then you would say at the end, how many points were you confined in an example? So I approach it a little bit different than he does. The conclusion is the same. Okay. Okay. In the second one, from the top, which is called Four Possibilities, the two circles overlap, but neither is wholly inside the other. So they're like this. Okay? Yeah. In the third one, which is called Mutually Exclusive, the two circles are entirely separated with no overlap at all. Okay? In the bottom one, which is called Mutually Inclusive, the two circles overlap completely. There is no other way that these two circles can relate. So if you think about it, you know, how are you going to draw these two circles? There's only those four ways that you can choose from. Yeah? Either one is a bigger circle and the other small, or the two circles overlap, or they're separate, or they're on top of each other. There's, you know, think about it. Can you find any other way that those, you can draw those diagrams between two circles? Yeah, there's only those four ways, okay, those four points. Okay. Okay. The focus of this procedure is not on the characteristics of the circles as a whole, the characteristics of the class P or the class Q. This fact will become clear with experience. Rather, the focus is on the members inside each circle, those things that are P and those things that are Q. Okay, and then it has, okay, let's go through them. So the one circle inside the other, the way you say this is, whatever is a P is necessarily a Q. Yeah. But whatever is a Q is not necessarily a P. Okay, you can also say it in this way. If it is a P, it is necessarily a Q. If it is a Q, it is not necessarily a P. So you can use the structure of if it is X, blah, 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 or whatever is X. Yeah, both things in English you can use. They mean the same thing. Okay. Then the two overlapping circles. It is not the case that whatever is a P is necessarily a Q. And it is not the case that whatever is a Q is necessarily whatever is a P is necessarily not a Q. Also, it is not the case that whatever is a Q is necessarily a P, and it is not the case that whatever is a Q is necessarily not a P. In other words, some P's are Q's and some P's are not. Some Q's are P's and some Q's are not P's. Okay? Can you think of an example of those two? What would a good example be? How about cars and Abby possessions? Okay. How would you compare cars and Abby possessions? Okay, is there something that is both a car and a possession of the Abbey? Yes, for example? Haroldina. Okay. Yeah. Is there something that is a car that is not a possession of the Abbey? For example? Yeah, somebody else's car. Yeah, Susan's car. Is there something that is a possession of the Abbey that is not a car? Yes, for example? A gong or a tractor. Is there something that is neither a car nor a possession of the Abbey? Yes, for example? Okay, yeah. Our neighbor's land that we are coveting. But we covet it for a good reason, because it's a fire hazard. Okay, so that's there you can see, you know, that if it's a car, it may be an Abbey possession, but it may not be an Abbey possession. If it's an Abbey possession, it may be a car or it may not be a car.
Does one of those two have to be a larger group that this one other one could be a part of?
No. No. Because if one is a larger group and everything that is the other one, then you have the big circle with the little circle inside.
Such a big qualifying group, and car is a smaller one.
You think we have more possessions than there are cars that exist in the world?
No, the other way around. The other way around.
It doesn't matter how many members each group has when you compare them. So when you draw the circles, it isn't that you have to draw one circle bigger because it has more members.
Okay. When he said you cannot compare the circles, then to discuss the size of a circle is still a discussion of the circle. You're not discussing the things that are in the circle.
Yeah, we're comparing the circles, which means the members of the circles.
The content of the circles. So to me, I saw the circles on the page when it was here a moment ago. It would be helpful for additional examples that show big circles and little circles. They're still separate circles.
It doesn't matter what size the circles.
It's just the content that we're discussing.
Right, right. When we draw it, like you can, let's say, arachnid. Okay. So, you know, when you compare arachnids and spiders, you can draw the circle of spider this big and arachnids as big as the room. Or you can draw the circle of spider this big and arachnids as just a little bit bigger than it. The size of the circles doesn't matter. It's the relationship of the circles to each other. Okay? Yeah. Okay. Because otherwise, you know, if you have a big difference in things,
like the Milky Way
and Earth. Then how are you going to draw that? You can't fit it on a piece of paper, you know, if you're trying to make the sizes analogous to the actual things. Okay? So then the third way, separate circles, whatever is a P is necessarily not a Q, and whatever is a Q is necessarily not a P. So if it's a P, it is necessarily not a Q. If it is a Q, it is necessarily not a P. Okay. So how do you compare, Tarpa and Semke? How would you draw that out? Two different circles. Okay. Are you sure? They're both people. Yeah, we're not comparing. They may have similar qualities in being people, but we're comparing Tarpa and Semke. We're not comparing people. Okay. So, third thing. And also, the things in the two groups may have some similar qualities. Yeah, both Tarpa and Semkha are people. So they have that quality in common. But those two are two separate phenomena. And if it's Tarpa, it's not Semkha. If it's Semkha, it's not Tarpa. Okay? Something that's both? Okay.
So how would you compare your book and my book?
Okay. So how would you compare this book and his book? How would you draw that? Two separate circles. Okay. Are they the same thing?
They're not the same. There's nothing that's both, even though they have very similar characteristics.
Yeah.
That's why I use that example.
Yeah. They look alike, but this book and that book are not the same. Okay? So some of the words we use very frequently in English have slightly different meanings. So the same. You can have two cups that are identical. In English, we say they're the same. In debate, they are not the same. They are different. Because one is this cup and one is that cup. Okay? So the two books in debate language are different.
This example, what I'm getting is that it is possible to have a class with only one member.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Because, okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, you so can have a class have with only one member, this book. Yeah, that's fine.
It feels like by doing this, we're like solidifying the inherently existence-ness of these of the objects. Or am I?
No. It may feel like we're solidifying them, but we're not. Yeah. It's just because this book and that book are different. Yeah, whether we're both books are empty, but are this book and that book the same? Is your money and his money the same? Things are conventionally different. Yeah. And they're empty at the same time. So empty doesn't mean things are exactly the same. Yeah. Okay. Not on a conventional level. You may say things are the same in this, that their ultimate natures are the same, because both of them have the ultimate nature of emptiness. But the two conventional things are not the same. Your money and his money are different. Yeah? Otherwise, you could go into his bank account and he could go into your bank account. That wouldn't work very well. Okay? Yeah? So it's the same, you know, when we talk about equalizing self and others. Yeah, we're not saying you're me and I'm you. We file different income tax things. We have different driver's license. Yeah, but we can say my happiness and your happiness are equal, you know, in the sense of being important. The importance of your unhappiness, the importance of my happiness are the same. There's no reason for me to cherish my happiness more than your happiness. Okay? But it doesn't mean your happiness and my happiness are the same. Because your happiness is experienced by you, my happiness is experienced by me. Okay?
I was trying to help resolve her question, and I think that we're talking about comparing things through our perceptual lens. We're not talking about comparing to inherently existing objects.
No.
We're talking about the things through our own lens.
Right. We're talking about things that conventionally exist, because remember, inherently existent things are non-existent. So we can't compare them.
So the emptiness of your book and the emptiness of Venerable Losong's book
They are different emptinesses.
Because the base of designation is
because
different.
Because the basis of designation is different. But to the mind that is directly perceiving emptiness, there's no difference that's being perceived.
was trying to figure out something today, and maybe it's just as simple as you have to have a definition for everything you're comparing.
Yeah, you have to know what something is in order to compare it to something else. If you don't know where it what it is, like, I don't know if you watched that video, somebody sent it around, where Dan Perdue and Thubten Jinpa were debating, and it was over. The question was, how do you compare compassion and justice? And first of all, I saw many faults in that debate. Because first of all, compassion and justice, you can't compare. They're two separate different, one's a mental factor, the other is some social something. I think what they were really asking is, can you compare an act of compassion with an act of justice? So you have, or acts of compassion with acts of justice. You have to speak about specific things. That was one problem I saw in the debate. The second is, okay, I think we have a definition for compassion. Yeah, wanting somebody to be relieved of suffering and its causes. What in the world is the meaning of justice? You know, when they started to debate that, I was scratching my head. You have to ask, what is the meaning of that? So that both people know what thing it is you're comparing. And justice, I don't know. It means a whole bunch of things to a whole bunch of different people. Yeah. You know, it's like, so you have to know. That's actually should be another criteria that he puts in here. And you know, yeah, he should put a fourth criteria that you have to understand the meaning of the two things that you're comparing. Yeah, because otherwise it's just mush. And that's how you can see that as, you know, how sometimes when we talk to each other, how we miss each other. Because we're using the same word, but we're defining it different. And we're not stopping to really make sure that we're referring to the same thing. So one of the things I've found by learning this kind of debate and reasoning is it makes you think in a very clear way. Yeah? It forces you to slow down and think, you know, how do you compare acts of compassion with acts of justice? Well, everybody could start talking about it, but if you don't know what you mean, yeah, then you get really confused in the middle of the debate.
Pardon? What if you don't agree on the definition, like with
justice? Then you can't compare it if you can't agree on the definition.
Would you debate then my definition versus your definition?
Yeah, you might be able to do that. Yeah, and say, you know, what is the real meaning of this? Yeah. But if you can't agree on a definition, you can't, you know, it's like baking a cake if you can't agree on what cinnamon is. Yeah, and it calls for 2 tablespoons of cinnamon, and you can't agree what cinnamon is, then. Yeah, one person may think, oh, you put cinnamon in. Oh, let's put these sticks in. So you put these whole sticks in your cake. Yeah, and then somebody eats the cake and they start gagging. Okay, so the fourth picture. Whatever is a P is necessarily a Q, and whatever is a Q is necessarily a P. So those two things are synonymous. For example, impermanence and conditioned phenomena. Okay, what's another example? Yeah, impermanence and functioning thing. Yeah, objects of knowledge and existence. Okay, let's just finish this, the two paragraphs below here. The information that some P's are Q's, but some are not, is communicated by either the first or second cases above. Okay, For instance, the information that some impermanent phenomena are sounds and some are not is handled by stating their relative boundaries of pervasion. Okay? So whatever is a sound is necessarily an impermanent phenomena, but whatever is an impermanent phenomena is not necessarily a sound. For example, a window. Sounds would be represented by the smaller circle inside the larger circle of impermanent phenomena. So the range of pervasion for impermanent phenomena is bigger than for sounds. If we factor in whether or not there is anything outside of the two circles, and here it gets very he learned it in a different way than I did, but anyway, it comes to the same point, but I find this confusing. But I shouldn't tell you that, because then you'll find it confusing. This makes perfect sense. If we because the power of suggestion. If we factor in whether or not there is anything outside of the two circles, there come to be 8 separate cases, 4 with at least one thing outside of the two circles, and 4 for which you cannot give an example of anything outside the two circles. If there is nothing outside of the two circles to speak of, the two circles would still be drawn the same way. Okay. However, for some of these comparisons, the fact that nothing is outside is noted as a separate case. To say that nothing is outside is not to say that only non-existents are outside the two circles, but that there is nothing you could speak of, be it existent or non-existent, that is outside of the two circles. If the two circles were P and not P, it would be the case that there is nothing to speak of outside of the two circles. Because there's everything that exists is either P or not P. Okay? So there's nothing to speak of outside the two circles. If P represents all cows, then everything other than a cow, existent and non-existent alike, would be not P. In whatever way P is identified, what is other than P would be not P. So there would be nothing at all left over. In this system of Buddhist reasoning and debate, for only 2 of the 4 cases in which there is nothing left outside the two circles, do they make a separate answer. Thus, there are only 6 possible answers to the question of how two phenomena compare. Because he's making it he's making it 2 different comparisons of whether there's something outside the two or not outside the two. And the way I'm doing it is just saying there's 2 things, let's go through these 4 points. And there may be something outside and there may not be something outside. Okay, so it's just approaching it slightly different. Okay, so then we will start on 3 possibilities next week. Okay, so practice a little bit this week. Look at different things and think of how you would draw the circles and then go through these 4 options and see which ones hold. Okay, he also did it as drawing a chart, and that the charts are another way. That's helpful to do it.